Yeah, so I played around with the title a bit, but after Dan's talk on Monday, I was, yeah, this is probably after Yambe's talk this morning, this is a much more conventional approach to getting higher sensitivity at high frequencies. So just a sort of quick overview of what I'm going to talk about. Predominant part of this talk is going to be discussing the thermal effects that you can expect from going to high power. I've tried to fold in some of the numbers that would be of interest to Dan, for example, from his loss equation. And then there's a little bit on what are the implications for Voyager. And then I've got a bit of an overview of squeezing at the end. That's largely sort of a very top-level view, so those of you in the audience who aren't necessarily as familiar with how squeezing works get a little bit of understanding of it. So just to recap, here is our ideal interferometer, at least as it currently exists. The basic topology is, as you know, Michelson. We have the Fabry-Pro arms. To amplify our signal, the power and signal recycling cavities allow us to optimize our power distribution and shape our signal response. And Runner, in particular, has been playing around with those a lot in the last 24 hours for Voyager. And then we have this output mode cleaner here, which strips off any junk light from the interferometer, the RF sidebands, anything that any light that's carrying out that doesn't really carry any signals, higher order modes. And the key factor here is there's multiple resonant cavities. Ideally, all of the light that's coming from the laser is coupled into the interferometer. All of the junk light, anything that's not carrying a signal, except for your local oscillator that you want, is rejected from the OMC, and all of your signal is coupled. All the signals created by the arms is coupled through onto your photodetector. And if that's the case, at least for advanced LIGO, your high frequency sensitivity should be limited by your shot noise. So this is a little out of date, and it obviously doesn't have any of the observing runs on here, but this is the sort of rough noise curves we would expect for advanced LIGO based on the design. Starting from low power in the early days and going up to higher power or full power, 120 watts in the interferometer. So this is relatively consistent with what we've done so far. We started at 20 to 25 watts in the interferometer, and for O3, we're hoping to put 40 to 50 watts in there. This high frequency sensitivity is limited by just the photon counting statistics, the shot noise, the amount of power that you're getting into the arms. So as you go to higher power, you can reduce that shot noise floor. And then again, the shape here is determined by the bandwidth of the interferometer, which is governed somewhat by the signal recycling cavity. So to improve the sensitivity, you want to increase the amount of power going into the interferometer. So if we want better high frequency sensitivity, then there's essentially three things we have to consider. Playing around with the bandwidth, I'm not going to discuss that here because Rana talked a bit about that, as did Thomas as well. And then sort of the other two knobs that you've got to play with are increasing the power or decreasing the quantum noise. So increasing the power has associated issues with it. Thermal lensing, which is what I'm going to focus on. Parametric instabilities, which is what Zhao talked about. And there's all other technical control issues. Decreasing the quantum noise is basically injecting squeezed vacuum instead of regular vacuum. But I like to think of us as right now we're like elderly people who can't hear high frequencies. And in fact, what we want to be is we want to be, young hoodlums who can hear these high frequency, and then yet they have these big speakers that scare them off with very high frequency noise. This is something genuinely you can buy to prevent people from loitering, prevent teenagers from loitering. So let's go to the basic conventional approach, which is to put more power into the interferometer. So we start with a basic low power interferometer, and we inject more light from our laser up to 120 watts going in. In advanced LIGO, we've got 800 kilowatts or more circulating in the arms. 800 kilowatts in advanced LIGO, potentially a lot more in third generation detectors. All of these optics, but particularly the test masses, have absorption, a non-zero amount of absorption. The test masses are great. They have coating absorption less than a ppm. It's like 0.5 ppm. But you know, if you've got 0.5 ppm and 800 kilowatts into it, that's 400 milliwatts absorbed power. And then you get these thermal gradients forms. You've got power going into this localized area. It flows out, and you get a temperature gradient in there. That leads to lenses within the substrate because of the thermorefractive effect. You get a surface deformation because of the thermoelastic expansion on the surface. You can also, particularly in Voyager and higher power detectors, get lensing within the beam splitter as well. I'm going to focus basically on the substrate lens. I have some slides which I put into sort of an appendix on surface deformation and correcting that. And if we get time, I can talk about that. And then I'm going to sort of talk about the beam splitter lens as well. So why is this, why is it problematic to the performance of the interferometer? Well, what it comes down to is if you have your electric field, your laser field incident on a mirror, in an ideal case, it's incident on the mirror, reflects off there, and just picks up on the wavefront the curvature of the optic. And that's just a quadratic change in the radius of curvature. If instead you have sort of bumps on the surface because of thermal expansion, you've got thermorefractive gradients within the substrate, then your reflection off the surface is going to pick up this thermoelastic bump. The transmission through here is going to pick up that thermal gradient. And I think the key thing here is that these are not, changes to the curvature. You can change the wavefront by changing, by reflecting it off a mirror, and it'll pick up a curved surface, and that's fine. We do that all the time, but these are not quadratic changes. These are deformations to the wavefront, which contain many higher order modes. So the transmission here, for example, I take a beam and I transmit it through an advanced LIGO test mass, which has absorbed 400 milliwatts, then in an axially symmetric point of view, this is what the optical path distortion or the wavefront distortion looks like. For a single pass, it picks up this profile, which is not remotely quadratic. To give you an idea of scale, the advanced LIGO beam is roughly 60 millimeters in radius. So here, if you have a look, that's around about 500 nanometers of optical path distortion. That's half a wavelength of light. That's a huge amount of optical path distortion. We characterize the scale of this by the RMS, so that's it's weighted by the intensity distribution. And in this case, the RMS value for this is about 150 nanometers. And that's full advanced LIGO, 400 milliwatts absorbed. We used to infer the existence of these by the effect on indirectly by the effect on other signals, but now we can directly measure them. So these are examples for wavefront distortion from that have actually been measured in LIGO. So here you see the result of uniform absorption in the Livingston ITMX test mass. So most of the high spatial frequency stuff you can see on here is just the noise in the actual sensor. But you see a relatively kind of uniform lens forming in the center there. That blue line represents the scale of the optic.
How do you know it's really uniform?
How do I know it's really uniform? I don't know it's really uniform, but I do know a lot of that high spatial frequency stuff is associated with it.
What kind of non-uniformity can you rule out?
Something like this, for example.
No, I meant on the left picture, would you say like the left-right absorption asymmetry is...
Like this? Left? Or...
I'm talking about the features in the image I just meant. Can you rule out that the absorption has like a 10% left-right asymmetry or top-bottom asymmetry or...
But you can, but you would have to determine how that would involve how well you could localize the center of the test mass within the frame of reference of the Hartmann sensor.
I guess I'm saying generically with this kind of stuff, can you do something where you take this Hartmann wavefront distortion and then invert it to figure out what the absorption pattern is?
You could, yeah. And then, you know, the confidence the confidence in that would obviously be dictated by the noise floor in the Hartmann sensor and then how well you knew
since you've done this Kalman temperature estimator stuff, does that give you some handle to estimate these higher order moments of the temperature distribution?
Not currently, but again, I mean, it's something that you could put into there. I mean, there's a lot of spatial information in here, but to start with, we just, you know, we fit just uniform absorption in there. So, I mean, the answer to your question is yes, you could do that, but no, we have not attempted to do that yet. But, you know, what we have seen, for example, is like highly localized absorbers in living at Hanford, for example, ITMX had this point absorber here on the surface. And these are extremely, there's an extremely high gradient in the wavefront there. Very, very localized point absorber. In this case, it was 250 microns or something in diameter, but it was essentially absorbing all of the beam that was an incident on that area. And so we ended up with an extremely high hotspot on there. And these, you desperately want to avoid these because we had to basically replace the entire test mass. So this completely ruins any ability to go to high power.
How much did the temperature increase around the absorber when there is like 100 kilowatt in the arm?
How much does the temperature increase around that absorber?
Yeah.
Well, it's a bit difficult to say because I couldn't model it to better than the spatial resolution of this. The Hartmann sensor has a spatial resolution of about 7 millimeters. We, after we took it out and looked at it, could see that the point absorber was maybe 250 microns. And, but it's extremely, I think it locally can get very high, like to the point where you'll damage the optic.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you know, 800, 900 degrees.
Wow.
No, I think it's thousands. So that if you just have a 1 watt laser beam and you hit a 1 micron particle, then the particle is not conductively cooled by the optic. It's purely radiative. So the black body equilibrium gives you a temperature of more than 4,000 degrees.
Yeah.
Kelvin.
Sorry.
So the glass melts, that's observed. The surface of the optic has the explosions of glass where the small point particles have erupted.
Yeah. And this will, on all the optics, this will happen the first time you go to high power, so. Why is this, why is it an issue? Basically, the overall signal to noise is reduced in sort of four main ways. We can couple in additional technical noise. That's, you know, not that interesting. We end up reducing the signal coupling to the output, which obviously you want to maximize the coupling of whatever signal you generate to the output photodetector, so that's bad. We can add additional noise, not from anything technical, but from just additional light, which adds extra shot noise beyond what you would expect. And then you can end up reducing the bandwidth of the interferometer as well because you change the resonant condition or the effective losses in the signal and power recycling cavities. So I like to think of it as you have all these different cavities. You like to have them essentially all matched to each other and all in tune together. So it's a little bit like playing an out-of-tune piano. Just to give you examples of how much power is scattered out, scales is the, as Dan's equation showed Monday, it scales as the power squared. So 4 milliwatts absorbed will scatter about 400 ppm. 40 milliwatts scatters 100 times that, around 4% of the power. And obviously 400 milliwatts, you know, it doesn't, at this point, it's just going to saturate, but would scatter nominally like 400% of the power.
At which point is that?
This is the total, that's the power absorbed by the optic. So in the test mass, for example. So mode matching is the name of the game. That's the issue here. You have multiple different cavities. You want to match them together. And that basically refers to like the spatial distributions of your intensity and your wavefront. And you can think of mode mismatch. I had a slide with a Fabry-Perot cavity and an overlap integral between the input field and the mode, but this kind of sums it up a little bit better. It's like mode mismatch is like trying to put a square peg into a round hole. This is my field, this is my cavity. I'm losing a whole bunch of my signal trying to couple it in there correctly. And nicely, I'm ending up with a whole bunch of channels for noise to come in as well when I'm trying to do this. So any thermal deformations, any thermal effects, wavefront distortion is going to either change the field that's incident on the cavity, or it's going to change the cavity distribution, the cavity eigenmodes. And so that's going to affect the mode matching. So when you have an optimally performing interferometer and you start introducing different distortions, you could analyze it in terms of the effect of ITMY and what effect that has in ITMX. But a better basis to look at this is to say, if I have common and differential effects, what's the effect here? So if I put in common mode distortion, that, for example, would be a common mode change to the ETM radius curvature. If I'm starting from a situation where everything's optimally coupled, then I'm going to end up with several effects. To start with, not all of my power will be matched into the interferometer. That will nominally reduce the carrier at the output, but you can control that by different control loops. What's probably more relevant is that if I start from a situation where I was optimally mode matched between the arms and the OMC, now I have I've taken what was all of my signal going to the output photodetector, and some of it is now reflected off the output mode cleaner. And then also some of the junk light that was all rejected by the output mode cleaner can make it to the output photodetector. So predominantly I'm getting less coupling of signal to the output. Alternatively, I could have a differential effect where one ETM radius gets longer, the other one gets shorter by the same amount. It's purely differential. In that case, I'm not really going to change the common mode coupling of the signal, but that differential mode is going to be entirely rejected by the beam splitter. All of it that I generate is going to come out through the beam splitter, and none of it is going to carry any signal on it. And so whilst a lot of that is going to be rejected by the OMC, you're going to end up with some junk light coming onto your output here. And then a third example is if I have lensing within the substrate, then that's going to change the resonant conditions of these two recycling cavities, which will end up changing the frequency response of the interferometer. So sort of this is by no means complete and doesn't really cover all of the thermal effects, but it just gives you an idea of if I have, for different effects, what is the dominant dominant result here. So common mode reduces the signal coupling to the output. Differential mode adds more noise to the output. And then, substrate lensing, anything within the recycling cavities is probably going to change the frequency response. So to correct these, we have the thermal compensation system. And this is really my only slide on this. The idea is that you're heating up the center of the optic, and so you get these thermorefractive effects within the substrate, and then on the surface you get these thermoelastic deformations. You can't easily cool the center of the test mess. So instead, we try and do the next best thing, which is add an annular heating via a ring heater around the edge, and then CO2 laser, which we can spatially control the intensity distribution to give us sort of an overall annular heat. And then we end up the optic is hotter overall, but it is now more uniform. And it's the uniformity of the surface and also of the substrate lens, which is what's important. So this kind of ties into, this is going to lead into to Dan's question about how well can we correct for something. So if we have this this wavefront distortion to correct for, you know, how do we determine what is the optimum heat distribution such that we can flatten this out as much as possible? And it's relatively straightforward to do. You just start with a distribution that you want to correct. We model different heating profiles, run both of them through a finite element model, and we end up with some residual lens. And then the only thing that you have to do is take that residual lens and work out some form of gain to convert that back into a CO2 heating profile. And then you just iterate this a bunch of times and you end up with what is the optimum thermal lens. What's the optimum heating profile, and then kind of therefore the flattest lens that you could potentially get. That's, if you look at that result here, that's the distortion we're starting with. And then this red line is sort of the residual distortion that we can get. So at least in theory, that the yellow line just shows you the intensity distribution of the main interferometer beam. So we've gone from the scale of sort of 500 nanometers on an RMS of 175 to something with a sort of peak-to-peak value of 10 nanometers or an RMS of 2.7 nanometers there. And so that ratio is a factor of 65, which is this number here in the equation Dan was looking at on Monday. In terms of loss, we can compensate for at least an advanced layer by a factor of sort of 65 or so. And the question is, could we do any better than that?
Aiden, just a quick question. What is, if you're just looking at the range, like the BNS range, how much would that go up if we didn't have TCS? Or would you not even be able to log or something?
You wouldn't be able to log.
Okay.
Well, it... at high power?
What are you talking about? Not be able to lock.
You'd be able to lock, but because this effect would then kick in and you would get more and more thermal lensing. So if you just tried to turn it up to, assuming that you didn't have any angular issues or you didn't have any parametric instabilities, say you just put 120 watts into the interferometer, then what you would see is your BNS range would spike up to something really high. But then as these lenses formed, it would rapidly drop off. And that would be largely because, for example, you had a lot of mode mismatch forming between the signal that you're generating in the arms and the output mode cleaner. So a lot of it would just be rejected by the output mode cleaner.
But it would be half as low or like so low that it would be like what, less than 1 megaparsec? I'm just trying to get a sense of how
But I think in Aidan's previous slide, he's shown that at full advanced layer power, just nothing will resonate.
That's, I mean, you know, at a certain point, you know, it...
Well, what are you assuming for this coding absorption?
Well, in this case, it's 0.5 ppm.
Okay. But if we do as good as the best that we've had in the past, then it's like 0.2.
Yeah.
So if we have 0.2 on all the mirrors, then what do you mean nothing will resonate? Full advanced LIGO power, I mean, it's only going to be something like 7 or 8 times the power we already had.
At that, yeah, you'd probably be able to maintain lock if your loss was of the order of, so 40 milliwatts was a loss of the order of 4%. So, you know, at full power, let's say we had 100 milliwatts absorbed, your loss would be of the order of maybe 25%. Yes, I mean, your the cavities
still operate.
Well, you could still operate, but then, I mean, at that point, that's, you know, the dominant loss in the recycling.
For our expression, it's something like we would lose 30% of the sensitivity or 40%.
Yeah. I would hazard that, you know, well, we can't just arbitrarily turn off other angular instabilities and control issues. So it's sort of a moot point, but... Yeah, I mean, you'd lose a lot of signal just from the mode matching to the OMC, for example. So for coding absorption, as we're pointing out, you know, 0.14 ppm was basically the lowest absorption we observed in advanced LIGO. Most of them were in the sort of 0.2. to 0.4 ppm level. Unfortunately, we've seen this creep up over the last couple of years. They look like they've gone up by, you know, 0.2 to 0.3 ppm over 2 years. I don't have any plots of that, but, you know, you could imagine that over time, a lot of material is depositing on the surfaces and just gradually, you know, the absorption is going up.
Can you explain this third term in the equation?
This one here?
Yeah.
Dan, can you explain this third term? Well, so this is the essentially represents how much loss, how much you're mitigating the loss by using TCS in the test mess. So this is the... how much the loss is reduced.
Yeah, but what is 30? Where does 30 come from and that sort of thing?
I think 30 is just there as a, in order to get this number to 1,000 ppm, right?
Well, why 1,000 ppm? I'm trying to get, usually people write this equation to say, this is a sort of standard level. We expect 1,000 ppm or something.
So you see what happened. So we ask the question, so what is the optimal power for high frequencies? And then it turns out after some power, the sensitivity becomes worse because of this loss. Yeah.
But who believes this third term?
What do you mean? Right now, because you see right now, the constellation is 30. In advanced LIGO design, the constellation is 30. In advanced LIGO design, absorption is half ppm.
I think we should not call it advanced LIGO anymore. It's not advanced in any sense. You're talking about LIGO 2015.
Yes, yeah. I'm talking about this. So these numbers just come from the advanced LIGO, Peter Pritchard's advanced LIGO paper.
Yeah.
With the requirements. So the Bayfront constellation is 30. So 3 from ring heater, 10 from CO2 mask, and then absorption half ppm, and then...
Is this arm cavity loss?
So this is loss...
No, it's not.
Yeah, that's the wavefront distortion loss between the arm cavity and signal size. So the scattering took high order mode.
Okay, but in the case that we have uniform absorption, why is this number only going to be 30? I mean, what would really prevent this from being 300?
This is why we invited Aiden.
Yeah, so the question is, like, can this do...
Well, I just wonder about the ring heater, not CO2. So if you have uniform absorption, like you say,
yeah,
then what? We just do as good as we, I mean, it's just a matter of the resolution of the number will we type into the regulator? How much heat?
No. Because you don't, this number does never goes to zero. And if you just use the ring heater, it's more like, at least in the substrate, is more like 30 nanometers or something.
But out on the edge, not in the middle.
No, in the middle. This is the weighted RMS. It's weighted by the intensity distribution. So it's what counts for the test, what counts for the field.
Okay. I'm not understanding this weighting. I thought the inset is showing the radius from the center of the beam.
It is, yes. So the RMS of this, weighted by this intensity distribution, is 2.7.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's something like, what's the mathematical best you could do with Gaussian heat distribution in a ring heater compensation?
No, this is ring heater plus CO2 laser. So with just the ring heater, it's more like an RMS of 20.
Why isn't it perfect?
That's a good question. If you think about, if you think about it, if you're putting in power into the center, you have to have some sort of gradient in there in order for it to flow out. But how well can you do with this is not something that we have determined yet. We've determined we can do well enough, but we haven't answered the question, what is the fundamental limit to how well you can correct for this? It's a slightly more difficult question to answer.
It seems like we can directly go to that design because the heat equation is just first order. And so it's easy to just invert it and say, here's the design temperature distribution I want,
mm-hmm.
and what heat input pattern do I require to make it uniform to whatever arbitrary number we want.
Yeah, it's not clear. It's not clear how low you can get it, if you can get this to some arbitrarily small value.
Yeah, in the math world, because it's just linear problems, so you can just keep adding point sources of heat until you just totally smooth it out.
Yeah.
There's a Laplace.
So you have a geo some like much higher resolution PCS system.
How much longer?
But is it worth commenting on the fundamental limit of TCS at this point?
I don't have numbers for what it could do, but it's...
Yeah, I'm not saying it's something you can just intuit, but I bet you, computer-wise, we could just work it out.
Yeah.
And say, given this geometry for the mirror, here's the best mathematic that we could do for wavefront canceling.
So to give you an idea, when I did this, I had... I was solving with a resolution here of... this is all axially symmetric, so that the elements that I had were 2 millimeters wide, and they were uniform distribution, and so I'm varying the amount in each of those elements. And so presumably if you went to a higher resolution, then you may be able to get that number down lower. What isn't clear if you can do it arbitrarily smaller?
If advanced LIGO has 30, then I'm sure... With my left hand only, I could do 300.
Okay.
Well, you see, then you jump into the next issue. I'm actually going to talk about Sagitta change. Because we correct the wavefront distortion, but Sagitta will...
We should
not really correct it.
We should do Sagitta.
Yes.
Mainly.
Yeah.
Or it's in the arm. And then do this wavefront thing only as the last correction factor. But mainly, we should do it on the inside of the cavity by doing the...
with the ring heaters.
Yeah, do a segmented ring heater by just doing not circularly symmetric heat.
Yeah.
So you could take care of astigmatisms and things like that.
How much can we do this way?
How much can we reduce the...
Because right now, I think 65. So 65 is a number when you start already getting lost from Sagitta. Because Sagitta, so you will correct with ring heater a factor of 3, and then another factor of 20 comes from this just geometry. So you already get, you will be limited by Sagitta if you can cancel away from distortion by 65.
In the arms, yeah.
Yeah.
So the RMS.
We could do a lot better.
Well, this is what we want to find out.
Inside the arm.
Yeah.
Well, inside the arms, so I have some slides on that, that you could do a lot better in the arms, way at the end here, so.
Well, that's four big regions, and who are substituting?
Well, you have to do a lot better in the arms, though, because I mean the overall distortion is less, but let's just go straight to it. The overall distortion is less, but it's obviously magnified by the finesse. Is the loss, so
yeah.
There is that one here. So if we did... yeah, so you could correct for the front surface. Yeah, so this is the surface deformation of the optic after just ring heater correction. I don't have a number for what the RMS is there, but you could sort of look at it and go, okay, it's probably going to be of the order of maybe 1 nanometer RMS. Yeah. And then you can have like the optimum surface deformation correct for 400 milliwatts of absorption. The main problem there is that you have, you're doing this spatially, then you could do it with a ring heater or you could do it with a CO2 laser, but you want to get that correct spatial pattern on there. And you know, one of the problems is that you have to then have you're injecting any intensity noise is going to couple into displacement noise, and so you're going to need a relative intensity noise of around about 10 to the minus 7 or 20 hertz, which is doable. It's technically difficult, but it's not impossible.
I think if you shine CO2 on the front surface, then you correct simultaneously segitor and waveform distortion.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that would allow you to do that. And you can get away with some of the intensity noise issues by using the same laser to couple to both optics. So it would be common mode rather than differential mode. So it is certainly feasible to do that. It's not at the level where I would look at this and go, oh, we need, you know, 10 to the minus 11 intensity noise. So it's possible to do that for sure. The one thing I don't have is like the loss from this for that residual there. Sorry, I don't have those numbers right now. Okay, so let's go back a little bit. The other option here, of course, is to get these numbers a bit lower for absorption. And unfortunately, there's not really, you know, massive investigation there right now. I asked a couple of people who were a little bit more knowledgeable about this. And at least in the short term, you know, there's no push to have absorption go lower than it currently is. And as Gary Lynn says, we're currently considering accepting higher absorption as a trade-off for getting lower coding thermal noise in A+.
All of these quotes are just about the next 1 or 2 years.
Yeah, no, that's right. That's why it says near future.
This has nothing to do with this HF issue.
No, but, you know, the relevant question is, if we want to do this, then we're going to have to... who are we going to get to focus on lowering the coding thermal noise? Because I think that...
The thing of it is you just have to redesign the coding. So if you look at the way that it's done now, people... Basically what you do is you change the layer thicknesses. We know that the absorption is all in the weird oxides, tantalums, and whatever nonsense. And so you can just look at how the E field goes as a function of the layer structure and change the thickness... It's a normal coding optimization.
Yeah. I mean, you're not just coding optimizing the coding thermal noise, but the absorption is a, you know.
I mean, in the coding optimization codes that we use, we optimize like 5 things at the same time.
Right.
There's the thermal optic noise, the absorption, there's the tolerance to the manufacturing errors and all of these things. And it's just, it hasn't been done for advanced LIGO because that's all very old technology.
Yeah. But is not the, if it's all in the weird oxides, which are like the tantalum layers, aren't we trying to reduce those anyway for coating thermal noise? I mean, do we not get the absorption for free, or is it more?
It's more complicated.
Yeah, okay. Well, anyway, you know, it's, I don't think it's as simple as Rana's pointing out, but, you know, if...
it's just a different optimization. So the advanced LIGO people are all about this 100 hertz Brownian noise.
Yeah.
And once we're no longer obsessed with that, then absorption can be made much lower.
Right. But can it be made much lower with the
yes.
current coatings?
It can be made much lower. We just use less of the highly absorbing material.
Okay. So I'm going to move on to Voyager a little bit. This is the noise curve for Voyager. It's now a little bit out of date. There was about, I think I've seen two or three different ones for Voyager this week. So I think for Voyager, at least the thermal compensation issue is less problematic. I mean, I said to you earlier that it was comparable to the advanced LIGO thermal lens. It's actually about a third of the size. That's with 3 watts absorbed. So maybe if we went to 10 megawatts, then it would be comparable in size to advanced LIGO. I've yet to, you know, do the full beam shaping calculation, see, you know, what's the correction factor that we could get. But again, it would be a sort of comparable size. If you take the current design, then, you know, the cryogenic operation is limiting the amount of power that can go into the test mass. We think we can only absorb 3 watts. Now, you know, if we decide that we want to put more in than that, we may consider, you know, the Rana laser cooling option or some other sort of conductive cooling. But essentially, the amount of compensation that we have to apply here, if we're applying heat to the silicon compensation plate, it's so far away from the test mass that from a cryogenic standpoint, it's not going to be limiting us. The solid angle that it's attending is pretty small. And so the amount of power coupling in there is minimal. So what about the beam splitter in Voyager? So this is, I think, an issue that needs to be explored. And what is not clear is what is the absorption going to be in... there's some heckling from the back here. So what's not clear is what's the absorption going to be in the Voyager beam splitter. And this, again, is going to introduce loss into the system via power being scattered out. But also, you know, if we get a strong thermal lens in the beam splitter, then, you know, it's going to affect the signal recycling response and, you know, the X-arm as well. It's going to be astigmatic and also balanced. It's going to create a large differential lens because it's going to only be on one side. It's only going to affect one side. But so absorption in fused silica at near infrared is going to be dominated by water, basically OH within the material. There's the fundamental sort of absorption of OH in fused silica is around 2.7 microns, and then about 1.35, there's a harmonic there. So if you reduce the OH content, then you get this absorption down a long way. But then there's this sort of multi-phonon absorption process where essentially you excite the sort of continuum of phonons within the material, and if you get enough of them combining, then they can absorb a photon. A photon can get absorbed and couple into multiple phonons within the material.
And you're talking about fused silica now.
Fused silica, yes.
But why in the context of Voyager?
Because we're talking about the beam splitter.
And there you can use it even for other wavelengths.
I'm sorry?
And there you can use fused silica even for longer wavelengths?
Yes. I mean, all of the optics are planned to be fused silica with the exception of the compensation plate and the test mask, which is silicon. Sorry, I should have gone over that a little bit more.
That's fine.
Yeah. So, but these numbers are not really tenable. If we really do have 26 ppm per centimeter in the silicon beam splitter, then, you know, we're going to have, with only 5 kilowatts absorbed, I mean, you know, we talked about earlier in the week having much more power in the signal recycling or in the power recycling cavity. Forget about that. I mean, if we stick with sort of the conventional design, if we have 5 kilowatts incident on it, we're going to have an order of a watt absorbed in there. So, what we really need to do is try and understand if this is going to be a limiting issue. And so it's not insurmountable. You know, we could consider going to silicon beam splitter or some sort of other exotic glass. The trick there is going to be having something that's manufactured large enough that we can support a large beam size. If we genuinely can't get any material other than silicon, which is, you know, going to have a minimal amount of absorption in it, then the option sort of comes is, do we consider having a smaller beam splitter? You would subsequently have smaller modes in the arms, and therefore your coating thermal noise would go up. But you could potentially have a much higher response at high frequency. And so this, again, is, I think, an instance where you're potentially trading off low-frequency performance for high-frequency performance if you go for a silicon beam splitter.
What's the issue with making a really big silicon test mask beam splitter?
Just the maximum size that we can make is already roughly the size of the test masses. And the beam splitter is rotated at 45 degrees, so it has to be of the order of 40% bigger in order to present the same aperture.
Is that not something that can be pushed on, though, technologically, or is that a part of it?
It's already being pushed on for the test masses.
Yeah. We're pushing on it for the test masses to get them slightly larger if we can. So, yeah, manufacturing a... We ideally wanted a sort of 50-centimeter, 55-centimeter beam test mass, and it's just nobody makes silicon balls that big. So Runner alluded to this in one of his earlier comments, that, you know, if we really wanted to go along this route, not necessarily for a beam splitter, but just for future detectors, you know, then we're talking about setting up a $300 or $400 million program just for materials research. So, you know, from the perspective of a sort of fundamental issue, it's not necessarily a fundamental issue, but it's you know, it's a cost of starting up a whole new field just to make large silicon masses. So, that's just kind of like the loss presented another way.
What does fundamental mean in this? Maybe I didn't get that.
The question is whether this multi-phonon process is really a fundamental process of a fused silica or not. And it seems to be just associated with the, we're still trying to understand it, but it seems to be associated with just like the silicon dioxide molecules, nothing to do with any contaminants within the material. And so if that's the case, it's likely to be a fundamental issue.
I don't understand this plot, because the geobeam splitter has 0.5 ppm per centimeter. So why is that different?
Okay, yeah. So this is actually loss in fibers. And so there is like a Rayleigh scattering effect. Yeah. And so there's not really absorption of that level at 1,000 ppm. So this originally said absorption, then I realized, actually, no, like this is absorption, but this part is just like scatter, and it comes from the fact it's a fiber. So, but it's difficult to get these curves for bulk or more for silica. So, yeah, I mean, if we took this, we just said, like, what's the maximum power we could put on the beam splitter, then we'd have you know, if you wanted to limit yourself to 6 milliwatts absorbed, which just corresponds to no correction and roughly the same amount of loss you were looking at, then you're limited to something of the order of, 10 to 20 watts incident on the beam splitter at 2 microns versus, a couple hundred watts at 15 nanometers. If you allow yourself to assume that there's going to be some correction, which I think is very reasonable, and so that's a factor of 50, then this might go up to, this will go up to sort of 500 watts, and this will go up to about 10 kilowatts as the maximum amount of power that you could really allow yourself to have on the beam speed.
You think we can correct beam speed to a factor of 50?
I think that is reasonable. I think the beam splitter correction is going to be more difficult, and that's largely because, first of all, it's going to be an astigmatic lens.
Yeah.
Secondly, you have to correct it in the X-arm, and there's a different lens that you have to correct in the signal recycling cavity. So you'll have to use an additional optic in the signal recycling cavity to have your signal recycling correction. That seems like an unnecessary technical complication if you can avoid it. So the real issue is whether or not this is kind of fundamental. So, and if it is, what can we do in terms of other materials? So this is something we're still working on. It seems like this is not a great reason to just choose 15 nanometers. You want to choose your wavelength based on what's the optimum response you can get from the interferometer. It seems like absorption is a really lousy reason to choose 1550 over 2 microns, but this is also a pretty extreme difference between those two wavelengths. So, how am I doing for time?
I think we're maybe another 15 minutes.
You only started at 12.
You start at 12 or 5 or so.
So I've got about like 5 or 6 slides I'm squeezing. Okay. All right, so that's kind of, that was like, what are the technical issues in terms of power loading? And then the other remaining question is, you know, what can we do to reduce noise via squeezing? Dan asked me to talk about this a little bit, and I'm not an expert in squeezing, so I'm going to give the high-level picture for the benefit of those of you who are not at all familiar with squeezing. But I think it covers what are the relevant issues for, if you're looking at really improving the level of squeezing in future detectors. So really quick, if you're considering the sensitivity of the detector, then what it comes down to is what's the electric field on our output photodetector? You have electric field which has your local oscillator. On top of that, and hopefully in phase, is your gravitation wave signal, and then there's some technical noise on top of that. And there's a transfer function which relates what the strength of this signal is to the frequency. That's the bandwidth of the interferometer that you have. You have junk light on top of that, but we're just going to ignore technical noise right now. And so then you have shot noise, which is this kind of ball of uncertainty on the end of your electric field vector. And this is the standard ball on stick picture. So you usually when people talk about squeezing, you can either talk about it in a quadrature picture, which I kind of like, or there's the annihilation creation operator picture, and that's actually more mathematically correct, but it's also it's a little bit more removed from intuition. So I'm going to stick with this. Here's our interferometer again. Effectively, this signal that's being generated is vacuum, which is coupling in. In this case, it's coupling in from the surface of the photodetector and going into the vacuum system via this open port in the beam splitter. It beats against the field, which is already in the arms, and gives us radiation pressure on the on the test masses. Then it comes out again and it beats against the field, which is incident on the photodetectors and gives a shot noise here. And this is a very sort of broad strokes overview. There's rotation of the field in terms of phase gets rotated into amplitude when you go from the detector to the when you go from the interferometer to the detector side and vice versa. So, but I'm not really going to get into that. And there's ponderable motor squeezing, which I'm not going to get into either. But the key point here is that you can't shield yourself from this. I mean, that you can put a Faraday isolator in here and that blocks the signal coming from the photodetector, but there's always an open vacuum. There's always an open port that sees the vacuum. So you can't block it, but can we shape it? You know, can we do something to at least change the distribution of this this uncertainty? And obviously the answer is yes. Here's our field on our detection photodiode again. That ball of uncertainty has to obey Heisenberg uncertainty limit, Heisenberg. But in a regular vacuum, it's just distributed equally in all quadratures. If instead we had a process which converted phase noise into amplitude noise, or vice versa, which you can do in some nonlinear crystals, then you could redistribute this uncertainty such that more of the uncertainty was in this case, the phase quadrature, and less of it was in the amplitude quadrature. So the total area still obeys that sort of Heisenberg limit, but you now have less, when you're making a measurement of the length of this vector, you actually have less uncertainty there. And so that's the key point here. It's like on a photodiode, you're detecting the intensity. And so this would manifest itself as less apparent shot noise. In a practical system, we want to generate really highly squeezed states, highly squeezed vacuum states, and inject them into the system. What sort of prevents us from doing that effectively? It's really the presence of losses. So if I take a squeeze field and I reflect it off a mirror, it's got 100% reflectivity, then any vacuum is just rejected by that mirror, and then I maintain a nice squeeze state there. If instead that there's a slight transmission in this, slight loss, then that presents a channel. Some of my squeeze field is lost, but critically then, some of the vacuum, the unsqueezed vacuum couples through, and so my state here becomes the combination of these two, which is a significantly less squeezed field. And so that's really all it comes down to, right? This is normally described as losses, and these two processes must occur at the same time. You get vacuum coming in as you're losing your field. But I always think of losses as a little bit of a misnomer, because really the problem is that you're actually gaining the vacuum here. So, but you can't have one without the other. So within the actual interferometer, there are multiple places that we can lose our squeeze field and gain vacuum. The Faraday isolator is one of them. Currently, we're actually up at 99% transmission through that Faraday isolator. So that's not too bad. The photodetector quantum efficiency is another one. It's sometimes easier to think about the way that the vacuum couples in here as having a quantum photodetector with a quantum efficiency of one, and then you've got a sort of virtual beam splitter in front of it where you've got your vacuum coupling in that way. And then, I think the photodetectors that we have now are of the order of like 98% to 99% quantum efficient. For the big one is like mode matching, and this couples back to another one of the things that Rana was talking about, was where we're having coupling in small fields, small beams into large ones. We really struggle to get mode matching done effectively there. So if I'm coupling in squeezed vacuum into this cavity mode and I'm only 60 to 70% efficient, then the difference between that squeeze vacuum, spatial difference between that squeeze vacuum and that cavity mode is going to be made up with unsqueezed vacuum. And these numbers are, for at least for enhanced layer, are terrible. So if we wanted to achieve really effective squeezing, or sort of extreme squeezing, and say, for example, let's ignore filter cavities. So we know that like the radiation pressure is going to go up, but we're only concerned about high frequencies. What would we need to do? And Dan was asking me about this. So there's some fairly extreme numbers here, but to give you an idea, we want to achieve an effective squeezing level of 6 dB, and let's ignore the externally generated squeeze field. Let's just assume it's, you know, we're injecting a squeeze field of 80 dB or something. Then the maximum total loss that we can tolerate is of the order of 25%, or distributed between sort of the five main loss mechanisms, that's around about like 5% each. And so if instead you want 10 dB, you've got to have a total loss of about 10%. You know, that means that my mode matching can only be 2% lossy through the entire system. And then as you go up to, you know, Dan was like, why not 20 or 30 dB? Well, there's no reason why not, other than the fact that, you know, for 30 dB of squeezing, the entire loss through the system has to be 1,000 ppm, 0.1%. Which when distributed across multiple components means that each one has to be have a loss of only 200 ppm. So these are some numbers for what we think, you know, losses are right now and in the future. So this is sort of 2017 numbers. It's dominated by mode matching loss, but there's also quite a lot of other effects in here. And we expect the total losses of the order of 20%. If in another 8 years we want to go to, say, a total loss of 10 or 11%, then this is what we think is achievable. So I've always argued with Rana about this representation because these numbers represent that fraction of the pi, not that fraction, not an absolute loss there. So in this case, this shows you the that in the future we think losses is going to be roughly evenly distributed between things, but the overall pie should be smaller than what we have currently. But you know, if we project that out, that's an increase from maybe 6 dB. 5 or 6 dB to sort of 10 dB over 7 or 8 years. And so at that rate, you know, if you're going up at 5 dB per 5 dB per decade is probably realistic, then in answer to your original question, it's maybe like 5 decades before we get to 30 dB of squeezing.
How many dB per decade does Jill get?
Per decade, 0.3 or 0.4. No, per decade, sorry, 5.
5 dB, yeah. So, yeah. So if we're currently at like 5 dB of squeezing, if we want to get to 30 dB, that's like a 50-year time horizon. assuming...
But to 12 dB, that's what we require. 12 dB is only...
another 10 years. Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that... also, the factors into this is... obviously, the generated squeezing. So you have to generate more squeezing than you want. But you know, if we want 10 to 12 dB, okay, let's say we're generating 20 dB squeezing, then we actually need more like 5% loss. So I think that's doable. You know, it's over the sort of 10-year time horizon. 12 dB is reasonable. So yeah, I mean, that's sort of the status, but there's nothing fundamental to prevent us from going to 30 dB other than that we have to improve all of these material sciences sort of exponentially. So, yeah, how to conclude? Basically, for Voyager, it looks like, you know, there's thermal compensation. It's not necessarily going to be too challenging from the perspective of compensating test masses and surface deformation. I didn't really get into the surface deformation, but there is no thermal expansion in Voyager because the thermal expansion coefficient is zero. The limiting factor looks much more likely to be issues with the beam splitter. So we have to figure out whether or not, you know, what are we going to do for wavelength and material for the beam splitter? Is that really, is that absorption really the lowest that we can get? And then I've got some numbers here for Den's equation, which are, I think, consistent with where we are now. And then the question is, can we get to 0.05 ppm? Rana just says yes, so I guess that's that question answered. And then, yeah, there's an overview of some of the squeezing issues as well. So hopefully that gives you an idea of the status of where we're at and what we think is feasible, at least over the next sort of 10 to 15 years. And yeah, that's it. So any questions? Yes, Tom.
How bad would losses from the filter cavity influence those numbers?
I think for high frequency, they probably don't, right?
Yeah. It becomes a little bit... It's no longer a single number because you have, this frequency-dependent loss. So anything that's reflected off shouldn't be too bad. But then lower frequencies are they're resonant in the cavity, right? So, I don't think, from the perspective of high frequency, that filter cavity losses shouldn't matter too much. They'll just limit that. You're not going to uniformly get 6 dB of squeezing. You'll get maybe like 2 or 3 at low frequencies.
Do you know how thermal refractive noise scales with the wavelength? Is that an issue? For any substrate, I guess.
Does thermal refractive noise scales a wavelength?
Yeah, whether that scales with wavelength as well, I'm not.
It's a good question. I think that the driving force for that is independent of the wavelength, and the only thing that varies is the thermorefractive effect. So the scale of the magnitude of it might vary a little bit. If the thermorefractive coefficient varies between 1550 and 2 microns, and then it will scale that noise accordingly. But I think that the shape should be the same. I don't think there's any other scaling. But I don't know, for example, I could probably dig up the numbers for the thermorefractive coefficient for silicon at 1550 versus 2 micron. I don't have it right now.
With a high frequency detector, so coin silver noise is probably not dominant. So is that possible to reduce the size of the test mass and reduce the beam split size?
Yeah. So I was looking at something that Rana walked out because he knows all this stuff already in typical fashion. Okay, so I'm looking for the Voyager curve. All right, so this is the standard Voyager curve. I'm hoping this afternoon Rana puts it up, but there was a configuration he looked at where it's all high frequency, and that came about by still a lot of power in the arms, but the arm finesse is much, much lower. And so what ends up happening is this coating the substrate thermorefractive noise goes up and becomes the dominant noise source, by far the dominant noise source at low frequencies. So there's a lot of that. I looked at that curve for a minute or so, but there seems like there was a lot of room for moving up the coating thermal noise. So in that scenario, yeah, you could imagine that, okay, if we were going to go for just a high frequency detector, then yeah, sure, we'll just go for slightly smaller beams. That would be easier to control. And also, you know, the Koenig thermal noise would go up, but you would have the budget at low frequencies to accommodate that. And then as a result, you could go for a smaller beam on the beam splitter, and then that would also allow you to explore other materials there.
How much power did you assume for that configuration?
Rana had 500 watts going in, and I think he had like tens of watts, if like 50 watts absorbed by the test masses. But I don't know what the finesse of the arms was. I mean, it's a, we should ask him in the discussion session to put that slide up and talk us through it. Because I thought it was interesting. I mean, it really just sacrificed everything at low frequencies. And in some senses, you know, all of this is really hard to deal with. And so if you just go to high frequency and you build it that way, you simplify a lot of stuff. I mean, you don't have to worry about Newtonian noise. The coatings become much less problematic. You know, you still probably want to work on your control systems, because we work really hard on those, and they're only the limiting noise source below about 100 hertz, but that's with a lot of work. But yeah, I mean, if you're willing to go for just a high frequency configuration, that opens up a lot of opens up having a lot of different configurations for the beam splitter and for the test masses.
Well, I think we can continue the discussion session. So it's lunch, right?
Yeah.
Do you need a 250?